Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Dr. Suzanne Stock, board-certified specialist in orthodontics. Dr. Stock is pleased to provide braces and Invisalign for children, teens, and adults in Iowa City and across Southeast Iowa. More online at drssortho.com.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, I'll talk with two short story writers who are also married to each other. Melinda McCollum's new collection is made up of stories that take place, almost all of them, in Iowa. It's called The Surprising Place. And Anthony Varallo's collection of microfiction is called Everyone Was There. They're both with me from Savannah, Georgia today. Hello.
Hey. Hello.
Thank you both for being here today. And Melinda, I want to start with you. The Surprising Place is a collection of stories, many of them with recurring characters. Most of them take place in Des Moines. And I think that it would be safe to describe the mood as bleak. Addiction, drug use, sale, abuse, heartbreak. These are recurring themes. Where did this collection start for you?
Well, I think a lot of writers end up, at least in their first book, going back to the place where they grew up, to certain situations or people, either that they encountered directly or that they had heard of, and kind of investigate that in their fiction. For me, I didn't initially set out to write a collection in which all the stories were set in Des Moines. That's something that happened over time. As I found myself going back to different settings, different scenarios, the book kind of gradually came together and ended up being primarily set in Des Moines.
Well, and the stories, when you read them, sometimes there are details that if you know Des Moines well, you might think, okay, I think I know
sure.
what she's talking about there. But mostly you know that they're in Des Moines because you say they're in Des Moines. Was that a struggle mm-hmm. for you to decide whether or not you wanted to name the place?
Well, I knew there were certain landmarks, perhaps, that I wanted to include, but I also didn't feel an absolute fidelity to depicting Des Moines in an objective way or a journalistic way. It's not really a sociological study of Des Moines or what it's like to live in Des Moines. I think the Des Moines that takes shape in my collection is probably a little more skewed. There's perhaps elements of surrealism in this version of Des Moines. So I think I sort of tried to have it both ways, where there are certain recognizable places or aspects of Des Moines, but also there's a lot of invention and a lot of exaggeration.
Well, and knowing that people were going to read it and that people mm-hmm. who knew you and maybe grew up with you and live
sure.
in Iowa now were going to read it, did you hesitate to name it as Des Moines when you were putting the collection together?
Right. Well, it's funny. My parents lived in Des Moines for decades. They moved to Charleston a couple of years ago. But my mother's book club, her longtime book club in Des Moines, was kind enough to discuss my book. And then we did a kind of phone-in discussion afterwards. But yeah, I think when you know the writer, sometimes you are reading their work and then you're thinking about the writer and you start wondering, you know, what if this is real? What can you assign to the writer? And so for my mother's friends, it may have felt a little bit disconcerting, like, what was Melinda up to while she was in Des Moines? You know, this is not the Melinda that I recognize. But, you know, for me, it's 100% fiction. I'm actually not particularly interested in writing, thinly veiled autobiography. Whenever I put out any work, I don't have a lot of anxiety about people confusing what's in my fiction for my own life. To me, there's a very distinct border between those two things.
Well, and why don't you introduce us to your work? Why don't you read a little bit from your story, The Fifth Wall? And I asked you to select what you wanted to read. So tell me why you selected this.
Well, this is one where, this is one perhaps actually where it is ostensibly set in Des Moines, but I think as the story goes along, it becomes perhaps a stranger vision of Des Moines. This is also one that's set in Des Moines where there's the appearance of these seasonal cicadas that anyone who lives in Des Moines know come out occasionally. That's something that appears in a few of the stories, and I think gives a few of the stories a somewhat eerie cast. So that was part of the reason why I chose this one.
All right.
Okay, so this is called The Fifth Wall. Sam's tackle box was wall-to-wall merchandise, packed so tight it fooled most customers into thinking that everything for sale was already on display. But Elena Hall wasn't fooled. Though the store stank of bait and brine, she could still catch the sour odor of methamphetamine, which Sam himself cooked regularly in a well-vented room above the sales floor. Elena came to the tackle box with her daughter, Jeanette, every week, though neither had much affection for fish. Still, the kid went wild in the place and broke away from her mother as soon as they passed through the door. Elena, troubled and aching, paused next to an arrangement of musky lures and watched her go. Weren't children's senses supposed to be more acute than adults? Shouldn't Sam's reek and clutter be too much for her girl? A dim memory surfaced from her own past, a trip to New York City, to Chinatown, the smell of fish so overwhelming that she begged her dad to return to Des Moines straight away. The fact that her daughter could handle Sam's, the fact that she sometimes seemed to love it, suggested that Jeanette was already leaving childhood behind. Physical senses dulling, their loss soon to be offset by increased insight and guile. A pain pulsed behind Elena's eyes. It frightened her, this coming Jeanette, this clever spy replacing her dreamy little tot who understood and wanted not much at all.
Melinda McCollum reading from one of the stories, The Fifth Wall, in her collection, The Surprising Place. And I'm curious, again, I want to ask where the inspiration for the stories you tell comes from. I mean, many of the stories made me think about news stories that I'd read of really bleak and desperate situations. And, you know, stories that make me wonder what happened first. How did people get to this point? What was your inspiration?
Yeah, I think actually sometimes news stories are an excellent inspiration for fiction in that they set out a situation, as you mentioned, but they don't really usually provide much insight into the motivations or into the whatever led up to that kind of dire situation that's being reported upon. So fiction, I think, is a way to kind of get into that and to think about how people end up where they do and why and also, you know, where they might go from there. So, you know, I lived in Des Moines until I went to college when I was 17. But even after I went to college, I was back in Des Moines every year, you know, staying with my parents every summer. And so for sure, I read the Des Moines Register all the time. And you know, there I think as what I'm kind of remembering is when there was this influx, actually, of methamphetamine and how that seemed to be bringing a lot of destruction, obviously, and you know, putting families under a certain kind of strain. And you know, that perhaps we're seeing more today, too, with the opioid crisis. So yeah, I think all of that kind of comes into it when you're writing fiction. You know, there's certain elements you may bring from your own life, but I think a lot of fiction writers combine their own life with other people's stories or with again what they've invented or what they've researched, and it becomes an amalgam of all of those things.
And that story, The Fifth Wall, the one that you read from, we see the main character, a mother, pursuing her addiction against, you know, every common sense, rational motivation, and even putting her daughter at risk, using her daughter in an effort to settle a debt and to get her hands on more drugs. And it's so heart-wrenching. And I mean, I read that whole story with my stomach in knots. And I'm curious, as a parent yourself, you have kids, right?
I do. I have a 14-year-old and an 11-year-old.
So in being the person who creates this story, creates this world, and these characters, then how does that how is that compatible with your mother self? And, you know,
right,
it's, you're the person, you're the creator putting people at risk.
Right. Well, and I that maybe goes back to what I was saying earlier, where for me, there is a very clear line between the worlds or the people that I'm exploring in my fiction and what I hope for or what I aspire to in my own life. So, but in that case, I did feel as if that mother, it's hard maybe to get this reading of her, but that in some way she is trying her best. I mean, she's very deluded about her ability to overcome her addiction and to then create a new life for herself and her daughter. But I also would hope that in the story that that her deep love for her daughter comes through as well. I mean, she's kind of beset by two very different impulses, I think, and can't quite control them. But yeah, I'm very interested in writing about characters like that who do have that kind of push and pull going on inside of them, as so many people do. Again, you know, in my real life, I would strive for a life of sort of serenity and peacefulness and all of that. In fiction, I'm not so interested in contentment and stasis. You know, I'm looking, I think, to shake things up a little bit more.
You also have recurring characters throughout the book. And I was surprised repeatedly. Mm-hmm. I would turn to the next story and think, oh, here we are again with a recurring mm-hmm. character, and we're going to take a break here in just a moment. But did that surprise you when you were writing that you kept coming back to the same people?
It did very much. Green is a character who I end up having five stories about. But initially, the first story I wrote about him was called He Ain't Jesus, and I thought that was it. I thought I had sort of captured what I wanted to capture about the character. Then later kind of went back to look at him as an adolescent and then returned to him a few more times at other stages of his life. And so, yeah, it was a surprise to me as well.
All right. Well, we'll learn about Green. We'll hear a little bit of He Ain't Jesus coming up in just a moment. I'm talking to Melinda McCollum. Her new collection of short stories is called The Surprising Place. Most of the stories take place in Des Moines, Iowa. She'll be reading at Prairie Lights Bookstore in Iowa City on Monday, July 23rd at 7 p.m. Anthony Varela is also with us. His new collection is Everyone Was There. I'll talk with him about his stories in a moment as well. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, I'm talking with two short story writers who also happen to be married to each other. Melinda McCollum is the author of the new collection, The Surprising Place, a collection of short stories that take place mostly in Des Moines and really explore the underbelly of Des Moines in many ways, exploring addiction and heartbreak and other kinds of bad behavior. Anthony Varallo is also here. His collection of microfiction is Everyone Was There. They're both with me from Savannah, Georgia today. And Anthony will talk a little bit about your stories in just a few minutes. But Melinda, I want you to introduce us to the character Green, who does become a recurring character in many of your stories. What you said, five stories feature him mm-hmm. altogether. Tell me about this man.
Well, I think he is a person who has a lot of conflicted feelings about the different elements in his life, sort of the professional path that he's following, his personal relationships, which within this book are primarily with his wife and with his brother. And again, it's that kind of ambivalence, that kind of push and pull that I was talking about earlier. In terms of his relationships, I think he is a person who has a longing for intimacy, a longing for connection, but also a fear of that as well, a fear of being vulnerable, a fear that his obligation to his family may somehow hold him back or may hinder him in some way. And so I think that kind of weight, that confusion perhaps about where he's going, what he should do next, is something that plays out in a lot of the stories.
Would you read for us a little bit of He Ain't Jesus?
Sure. Okay, He Ain't Jesus. Green bought the one-room bank building on the outskirts of Des Moines for himself. An air mattress inflated in the vault, a candle in a jar of sand, and all that was left was to pick up a girl and a few bottles. In the morning, sun came through the bank door's ox-eye window and made him and the girl and the room red and holy. No, he thought, taking it all in, nobody knew everything about him yet. He dropped off the girl and went home to his wife in town. Nora was sitting with his brother, Roy, at the kitchen table, biting toast and drinking coffee. The sight of them filled him with a rage both oversized and misdirected, but he didn't resist it. These days, he'd follow anything to wherever it led. And, Nora said when she saw him. First, this one unexpected thing happened, he said, and then another thing, and before you know it, boom, it's dawn. He poured himself a cup of coffee from the percolator on the counter, plus traffic. His wife picked up her cup and walked by Green, spilling coffee onto his shoe. She made it to the living room before he heard her begin to cry. A single lie is more convincing than a lot all at once, Roy said, jerk. He took hold of his brace, straightened his leg, and stood. He was younger than Green, but looked older, hair fine and thinning, nose copper, eyes set low in his face. There are enough good times in the world for us both, Green said. No need to be jealous and call me mean names.
A little bit from the story, He Ain't Jesus, which introduces us to this character, Green. And he doesn't make better choices as time goes on.
Not necessarily, no, unfortunately.
What made him such a compelling character to you? What brought him back to you again and again?
Yeah, I think initially I did like the idea of looking at him. This He Ain't Jesus was the first story I wrote about him. And then the next story, I jumped back to when he was 16 years old, and it talks more about Roy, his brother, has polio, and it talks about when Roy was first diagnosed with polio. The earlier story talks about Green's own ambitions to be an architect, which never are actually realized.
Right, he's a young man full of promise, but he's overconfident and over promises.
Yeah, and that's something I think that's kind of something that he has to struggle with throughout the book, that there's this gap between what he wants for himself or what he thinks he deserves and what he actually has. And that, I think, that disconnect creates a lot of trouble for him and others.
And for everyone he seems to encounter.
Unfortunately.
Did you think about turning this into a novel as this character came back to you again and again?
I didn't. I think, you know, that's something that maybe is becoming increasingly popular, sort of doing a novel in stories. And I think that can work wonderfully well. With Green, I didn't have that desire. On the other hand, I did write 5 stories about him. So, you know, perhaps I could have pushed it a little more and made it all about Green. But I really love the short story. And I actually love, in a collection of short stories, seeing how the different stories speak to each other and the ways in which they may resonate with each other. And so I was pretty committed to doing this as a collection rather than a novel.
Now, you know, in recent years, when did you graduate from high school?
Oh, 1988.
All right. Okay.
So, quite a while ago.
So in the years when you were growing up and yes. Then later, I mean, we've seen a big transformation in the city of Des Moines.
Absolutely.
And, you know, we like to brag about the city of Des Moines. We mm-hmm. like to tout it as just a really wonderful place to live. And, mm-hmm. you know, the transformation that you've witnessed, that I've witnessed in my lifetime mm-hmm. is pretty incredible, pretty
Absolutely.
Impressive. So in creating these stories that show us a really dark side of Des Moines, which mm-hmm. is definitely there, mm-hmm. what kind of a reaction did you expect to get from people who live in Des Moines, who live in Iowa? And, you know, we love to tell these positive stories about ourselves and our state.
Sure. And I love Iowa, and I loved growing up in Des Moines. And I feel like it was absolutely, it gave me so much to build on in all aspects of my life. So I never had any intention of mounting some sort of critique of Des Moines or expose of Des Moines. And again, I really just don't personally, I don't see the book as making any kind of comment on Des Moines as a city, as an entity. It's really, for me, more of the backdrop for the characters themselves. I mean, that's what I'm most interested in, are these particular characters and the particular conflicts and emotions that they're dealing with. So I did not necessarily anticipate getting pushback, I guess, on setting the book in Des Moines.
Have you gotten pushback?
Not particularly. I mean, I think I think some readers may be looking for a version of Des Moines that lines up more closely with their own experience of Des Moines. I think that's true for readers in general. There are some readers who look to fiction because they want to see some reflection or some version of themselves on the page. And that can be, I think, incredibly rewarding for a reader. I think other readers maybe have a little more leeway or maybe actually want to see versions of themselves or the places they know that are different or that show them kind of another angle on something that may have been familiar to them. So that might be more of the direction that this particular depiction of Des Moines is. It's not, yeah.
You write about these characters that it would be easy to condemn as mm-hmm. despicable. Sure. You write about them with empathy. Mm-hmm. Not condoning decisions or right. behavior, but they're human. Mm-hmm. And, you know, all of them have emotions that all of us can relate to. What do you mm-hmm. want readers to take away from the experience? I mean, given that many of us will not have that kind of experience as part of our life experience, I mean, I'm sure some of your mm-hmm. readers will, but for a lot of readers, it's going to be a glimpse into a world they're not familiar with.
Sure. And I guess this maybe is going along with what I was saying with this idea of that. I think sometimes when you immerse yourself in fiction, it does allow you to have at least some sense of how other people are living their lives. You know, if it's done well, if the writer has done their job, they've immersed you in this other person's body. They've brought you close to that person's mind and to their heart. And so maybe you are able to have some empathy for something that you wouldn't initially, or you're able to kind of imagine something that you didn't think you could imagine before. I mean, and I think another thread that maybe runs through these stories, and this is sort of a nod to the title, The Surprising Place, which on a literal level was a slogan for Des Moines, but also just this idea that in life, you know, we do often come up against people or situations that are unexpected and that shake us to our core. And I think a lot of my stories are interested in what do we do when that happens? You know, how do we react? Who do we reach out to, or who do we push away?
I'm talking with Melinda McCollum. Her collection is called The Surprising Place. She'll be reading at Prairie Lights Bookstore in Iowa City on Monday, July 23rd at 7 p.m. She grew up in Des Moines and graduated from the Iowa Writers' Workshop. Anthony Varallo is her husband. He's also a short story writer, also graduated from the Iowa Writers' Workshop. And I would love to hear from both of you, so I'll let Anthony go first since he's patiently waiting his turn. But you have both chosen not the most lucrative, you know, part of writing and yeah. publishing to focus on short stories. So why short stories? Why is this form so appealing to you? Anthony?
Sure. I have always loved the short story. And it starts with reading for me. So I prefer the short story for what I choose to read. And I also, and Melinda and I both teach, and we teach the short story. So we're just sort of immersed in the short story. So in a strange way to us, the short story feels very sort of natural and familiar and what we know. And I know that's not how readers feel. Readers feel like they'd like a novel, thank you very much, or a memoir. For many readers, the short story feels, I think the way a reader reacts is they get to the end of the story and feel like, that's it? How could it end like that? Or there's not enough quite happening in the story, or they want to know what happens to the characters, which is one of the luxuries of the novel. It's a beautiful thing to find out what happens to the characters. And you don't always get that in the short story. So that can be a little bit confusing for novel readers to try to transition to the short story.
So but you say as a reader you prefer short stories. Do you remember when that started? Was there a short story that you fell in love with and or a collection that you fell in love with as a young reader that made you think, this is where I want to be?
Yeah, well, I kind of got a late start towards finding out about the short story. It wasn't really until I got to college that I began reading short stories massively. And the first stories I read were things like Hemingway was a huge influence on me, Raymond Carver, just sort of classic and canonical writers who were, I'm kind of embarrassed to admit, pretty new to me at that point. I just didn't know their work. But once I began writing my own stories, again, this was in college, I began reading these writers and trying to figure out that really beautiful form, the short story. How does it work? How does it? I tried to take it apart and analyze it and look at it. And so I've just really enjoyed writing stories my whole life. And of course, I read novels just as all readers do, and I love the novel as well. And I'm working towards writing some of those, but I always love the short story.
Can you name specifically one short story that you read when you were kind of discovering this genre that just knocked you flat, that you feel is mm-hmm. is exactly what a short story should be?
Mm-hmm. John Cheever's The Swimmer. When I read The Swimmer, I couldn't believe just the language, the precision of the prose. It's terribly funny. It's terribly sad. Nettie Merrill's, of course, swimming the Lucinda River, all the swimming pools in the backyards of the neighborhood where he's fallen from their good graces. And the last page of that story, that's about as good as you can get. I would give anything to write a fraction as good as the last page of Cheever's The Swimmer.
Melinda, what is it for you with short stories? How did this love affair begin?
Well, it's funny. I, too, before I went to college, really was not very well-versed in what was going on in contemporary short fiction, but then went to college and started taking fiction writing classes, and then that whole world opened up to me. And one of the things I love about short stories is just kind of the energy of a short story, you know, because you have fewer pages to work with. Things tend to happen faster. Sometimes I think they hit harder. The language has to be even sharper. And I love the intensity of a short story. That's what drew me to it as a reader. And that's what I love about the form as a writer.
So do you have a short story that you remember that just knocked you flat?
Well, I read a couple of stories actually by Dennis Johnson, Car Crash While Hitchhiking and Emergency, which blew my mind pretty much in terms of kind of understanding what a short story could do. He really is audacious in terms of the language he uses, in terms of the narrative movement in the story. He plays around kind of with time. Everything is sort of slippery in the story, but it's also crystal clear at the same moment. So for me, he was one early on who I kind of aspired to do what he was doing.
And Anthony, you mentioned how short stories often leave you wondering or leave you wanting more. Your collection, Everyone Was There, is made up primarily of incredibly short stories, like two pages or less than two pages for many of the stories, a microfiction. Where did this form come from for you? When did you first start experimenting with it?
Sure. Yeah, most of the stories in Everyone Was There are 500 words or fewer, which is short, about a page and a half. And I began writing these stories as exercises. They were just personal challenges to myself as a writer. And I wrote them while I was working on other books, on longer stories, on traditional 5,000-word length stories. And years passed, and I began to collect more and more of these. Again, I thought of them as exercises or experiments. And I found that whenever I gave a reading or had to present my work to an audience, I would always like to read one of these first before I read the full-length story. And I really enjoyed that. I liked having that short little sort of introduction that I could read before the longer story.
And what made you like it? Was it how the audience reacted to it or how your performance?
No, how the audience reacted to it. And I felt like I could sort of give a sort of an introduction to my work that was very graspable. Like they could hear a whole story in 2 or 3 minutes and sort of take it in, rather than the longer haul of 20 or 30 minutes. And it's fairly difficult to listen to someone read a short story, no matter how invested the listener or the reader is. It's kind of hard to pay attention to all the particulars. So I feel like I don't write poetry. I love poetry, but I don't write it. And I feel like in a way, this is as close as I'll get to that, the feeling of reading a complete piece that's all can be revealed in a moment or in a few minutes.
We are going to take a short break. We'll be back, and you'll read for us a little bit of your microfiction in
Great.
Just a moment.
Oh, yeah.
Anthony Varallo is here. His collection of short stories, very short stories, most of them, is called Everyone Was There. Also, Melinda McCollum is here. Her collection is called The Surprising Place, and she'll be reading at Prairie Lights Bookstore in Iowa City on Monday, July 23rd at 7 p.m. We'll continue our conversation in a moment.
Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Dr. Suzanne Stock, board-certified specialist in orthodontics. Dr. Stock is pleased to provide braces and Invisalign for children, teens, and adults in Iowa City and across Southeast Iowa. More online at drssortho.com.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, a conversation with two short story writers, both graduates of the Iowa Writers Workshop, where they met. They are now married. Melinda McCollum is here. Her collection of short stories is called The Surprising Place and takes place mostly in Des Moines. Anthony Varallo's collection is called Everyone Was There, and it's a collection of very short fiction, micro fiction. And Anthony, I would love for you to read one of the stories for us. I think you're going to read My Enemy.
Yeah. Okay, I'll go ahead and read that story. It's called My Enemy. I saw my enemy today. He was in the car ahead of me talking on his cell phone. He had his visor down and seemed to be observing himself within its square mirror. When he stopped at a red light, I could see my enemy's lips. They were small and thin, yet full of malice. The light changed. I honked my horn. "Let's go," I said. My enemy gave me a look, then pulled away. "Finally," I said. I was late for a dental appointment. The appointment went well until my dentist introduced his new assistant, and I saw my enemy extend his sinister hand. "Hello," I said. "Hello," my enemy said. He went to work. "Let me know if you feel any sensitivity," my enemy said, and shoved a small harpoon into my gums. I could see my enemy's eyes creepily glass behind a safety mask. He scraped between molars and incisors. I felt pain shoot through my jaw, but didn't say anything. I tasted blood. My enemy smiled. I spent the rest of the morning at work responding to email. An entire page of email contained the same subject line, business proposal. I opened one and read my enemy's propaganda. "Dear who it may concern," the message began, "a fortune of high importance awaits you as the benefactor of the heir of the Schullerhauser dynasty, etc., etc. "Dear Prince Schullerhausi," I wrote, "what would you know about sensitivity?" I clicked send and left work early. On the way home, I stopped by the supermarket. I wanted those little pretzels shaped like wagon wheels, but I couldn't find them. An employee was shelving potato chips, and it wasn't until he turned to answer my question that I realized my enemy was moonlighting as a grocery clerk. "They don't make those anymore," he lied. His acne was hideous. When I left the aisle, I glimpsed my enemy shelving the pretzels where I'd already looked. When I arrived home, my trash cans were scattered across the driveway. My enemy had stolen the lids. He'd craftily placed them on top of his trash cans as if I wouldn't notice. "Oh, I noticed," I said, as I returned them to their rightful places. "I noticed, all right." That night, the phone rang in the middle of my favorite television show. "Hello," my enemy's voice said. "I hope I'm not calling at a bad time, sir, but I wanted to inform you about a special low-interest credit." "Listen," I interrupted. "If you touch my trash cans again, I'll break your neck." "Sir?" "And I found the pretzels," I said. My enemy paused, then whispered, "Where?" "Behind the Doritos." "Next time, I'll hide them better," my enemy said. "You're a lousy dental assistant," I said. "I'll steal your teeth," my enemy hissed, but I'd already hung up.
My Enemy from Anthony Varela's collection, Everyone Was There. And that actually, that was a story that I had marked to ask you to read, but it was also one that you chose. I know why I picked it. Why did you pick it?
I picked that story because I like the story behind the story, and that is that my son, who is now 14, when he was much younger, gave me the idea for the story basically wholesale. When he was in kindergarten, he had a very, very close friend, and every day when he came home from school, he would tell us about their exploits and their adventures and what they'd done in school together, until one day they had some kind of like kindergarten falling out on the playground or in the cafeteria. And my son began referring to his best friend not by his first name, but as my enemy. So he would come home and say, "My enemy and I had juice boxes today," or "This is my enemy's favorite TV show," or "My enemy has a shirt just like that." And there was something about the way he said it, just completely neutral, sort of neutral tone, that I loved. And so I gently borrowed that idea from my son and made it into a story. And ever since then, my son swears that whenever I read that story, I have to give him credit. So
that seems
I am now adhering to those guidelines.
Well, it's actually very funny because when I read the story myself, I was thinking about my son, not because of the phrasing, but just in the terms of, you know, having a terrible, no good, very bad day.
Right, right.
Where
right.
It does feel like everyone's out to get you. And, you know, although you encounter a number of different people,
right,
it
right.
still feels like the world is against you.
Yeah, and the story does have that kind of Alexander, no good, very bad day. It has that sort of feeling or tension to it. And that was something fun for me to write. It's a very sort of a fairly plotted story that builds and builds to a moment. And there's even a good old twist ending that sort of flips everything that came before it. And that's not usually my move in a short story. I'm not usually doing something so overt and sort of heavy-handed. So in a shorter form, I feel like I have this nice freedom to do things that I maybe wouldn't feel so comfortable with in a longer story, but it feels okay at 500 words.
Well, and that story, obviously, it's very funny. And it feels almost constructed like a long joke with a great punchline,
right.
Which
right.
is not necessarily typical of the stories in your collection. That one is maybe extra funny. And many of the stories are very funny, but they're also heartbreaking, too. I mean, you write a lot about parents and kids and really capture sort of this, I don't know, this middle-aged ennui where people are a little bit lost and don't know how to find themselves. Where do the inspirations for the different stories that you tell come from and that recurring theme of parent and child?
Yeah, I tend to write about parents and children, not only in this book, but in my other three collections. And I'm just sort of drawn to that subject matter. It's not really by choice, but as I've gone on, as I've been writing, you realize as a writer that there's only a certain amount of things that you can write about well and write about convincingly. And I think for me or for many of my students, that's not how it feels when you start writing. You feel like, I can go anywhere. I can write about anything. Anything is possible. And then you're sitting at your laptop 2 hours later and the cursor is blinking and the page is blank. So you sort of realize what your limitations are as a writer, and you live with them, and you learn to trust what you write about well, and how you can sort of explore that material. So for me, it's more about a lifelong learning that's what I tend to write about, and that's the subject matter I'm drawn to. But it's a little bit mysterious. I can't really say it's because of this, and that would unlock everything about why I write that. It's just what I'm drawn to.
Well, and Melinda, I kept hammering you with questions about why you were drawn to such dark subject matter.
Sure.
I mean, and Anthony, in your stories, there is that sense of disconnectedness. Is that, does it stem from something that you feel? I mean, we all feel that. Or is that something that you see when you look at other people?
It's at some point, every story that I've written is reflects at some point about my lived life, my experience. Because a story can't spring, in a sense, from nothing. It can't just sort of be a complete work of pure art. And that would be nice, but alas, it's hard to do that. So there's some sort of way that I see the world, the way that I apprehend my own life that's coming through in these stories. Yet, with that said, I am aware that I'm writing a story. I am aware of the conventions of a story. And one of those is tension or unease, problems, conflict. So I'm looking, I'm sort of sorting out the characters, the material, and looking for that kind of tension as I'm writing the story.
I would love for you to read another story for us, and this one may be the truest story in your whole collection.
Yeah. This story is called The Good Phone. It's quite short. It's only 300 words. The Good Phone. We called it The Good Phone, the downstairs telephone mounted to the kitchen wall to differentiate it from the only other telephone in our house, the green trim line in our parents' bedroom. If we were upstairs and the phone rang, we would race to the bedroom, dive across the bed, and try to answer by the third ring. This, a game of our own devising, a game we sometimes expanded upon, assigning meaning to the third ring, as in, if we don't answer the phone by the third ring, the world will explode. The trim line had illuminated push buttons that glowed as greenly as fireflies, but the caller always sounded like they were trapped inside a tin can. Usually the call would be for our parents. Mom, Dad, we'd announce, telephone. We'd hear them rise from the living room sofa or family room sectional and say, I'll take it down here on the good phone. And then we'd listen until they picked up downstairs, their voices blooming in our ears. Hello? The good phone had gray buttons and an ivory base. The receiver was heavier than the trim line, perhaps one reason call sounded so much better, clearer. The good phone had a long cord that twisted into complex loops and tangles. Try to stretch them out, and they'd only return in an instant. Later, in high school, when we had calls of our own, important calls, calls from boyfriends and girlfriends, we'd take those on the good phone. And much later, after we'd moved out of the house, after we'd become adults, whenever we called home with disappointing news, news of parenting dilemmas, of marriages ending, of health problems and loss and sorrow and pain, our parents would always say, wait, let me switch to the good phone.
Anthony Varallo reading The Good Phone from Everyone Was There. You both write short stories. You both teach short stories. Do you collaborate as writers, Melinda?
We do not collaborate as writers. We also, in addition to us both teaching and writing short stories for a number of years, we actually shared an office as well. So, yeah, we in some ways are very steeped in each other's work, if only by proximity. But we don't typically write together. And in fact, we often don't show each other drafts until they're pretty far along, and in some cases, not until after they're published. So for whatever reason, we both tend to be somewhat secretive writers, though eventually, of course, we share.
So was that is that an approach that you've developed over time? Did sharing go badly early on?
No.
The scandal. No, I actually think I'm probably more open to Tony seeing my work at an earlier stage, because I usually get to some point with a story where I feel like I can't see it anymore, or I suddenly worry it's just absolute garbage, and so I need an outside set of eyes. But ever since I've known him, Tony really likes to hold on to his stories until he's got them where he wants them to be, and it's paid off. It's a good process for him.
And how did that develop for you, Anthony?
Oh, I just feel like it's just sort of I've understood that writing is essentially a solo act. It has a communal aspect through reading, through teaching, through writing workshops, and I love those aspects of being a writer. But the generative part, the composing a story or a novel chapter, really is sort of isolated and solo. And there's something about that I like. So I think I don't really have too much of a desire to collaborate, and that just may be you know, either like some weird crimp in my personality or like I'm just lack of generosity. But I do love the solitude of composing stories. But once I'm ready to show them to Melinda, I mean, I will show them to her and she gives me feedback and, you know, then it's fair game. Everything we can talk about the craft or what might be better in the story. So there is some very low level editorial collaboration once the story has been written. But as Melinda said, not much prior to that.
Well, and you're describing the solitude, the quiet of the writing process. Mm-hmm. You're also, of course, married with kids. Mm-hmm. Solitude and quiet are not things that tend to go along with that lifestyle. So how do you help each other out to find the space to be writers in addition to your day jobs?
I can start by saying, for many of the stories, and everyone was there, I wrote them at a cafe, this near our house, and I would get 2 hours at the cafe. This is when our kids were very little, and I would race to the cafe, and I played a little game with myself as I was driving. I would try to say, I'm not going to think about what I'm going to write at the cafe. I'll just spontaneously begin writing something, having no preconceived idea what it is. And many of the stories in this book arose from that game, I guess you would call it. But I had 2 hours of time, and then Melinda would have her 2 hours of time later. I don't know if she went to the cafe or to her office, but we would sort of spell one another with giving each other a little free time, and the other would be the caregiver, the caretaker for the children, and it seems to work pretty well.
The being in the same field, in the same house, in the same field, teaching at the same college, is there a competition element to what you do?
No. No, and we met in grad school as MFA students, so it's just always been a part of our life together, a part of our relationship. It's actually, I think, a really wonderful thing. It makes it very easy to gossip with each other or to, you know, share opinions on books. I think it really is a very productive and supportive aspect of our relationship rather than something that's competitive or divisive.
And writing is a pretty lousy competitive sport. It just is. It's not anything you want to look over your shoulder at the person next to you and see what they're writing. It's just not part of what it's like to write. So, yeah, there's no competition.
But you're fighting against some pretty basic human impulses there. You can say it as if it would be terrible, but it has to enter your mind on occasion.
I'm not so sure. Maybe if one of us, you know, suddenly launched to the upper echelons of, you know, writing success and, you know, we're pulling down national book awards and all, then, you know, maybe there would be some sense of, oh, why not me? But I honestly don't think so. The thing is, it's really gratifying, I think, to see your partner do well. And yeah, it's just been a pleasure to see Tony publish so many books all these years.
And same with Melinda.
Well, thank you both so much for being here. And I wish you both success and equal success and happiness. Aww,
thank you.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you so much.
Melinda McCollum, her new collection is The Surprising Place. She'll be reading at Prairie Lights Bookstore in Iowa City on Monday, July 23rd. And Anthony Varallo, his collection of microfiction is called Everyone Was There. Talk of Iowa is produced by Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe.